This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. One of the two Northwest Indiana school corporations that have put questions before the voters in the June 2nd primary election ballot, although it was a primary election politically, it was a question asking for support for two school districts. And we have the superintendent of one of those two school districts with us to talk about it, in particular in Hanover Township. In Hanover Community School Corporation, the school district asked its residents to vote yes twice about the two referendum questions that were on the ballot. And with us is Superintendent Dr. Mary Tracy McCauley. And Dr. McCauley, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations, first off, for going through all of the efforts once again and actually having a successful time about this. I guess, in short, the two questions, you got yes for both. And it looks like that you got a very resounding show of support, if I read the numbers right.
Yes, very much so. We passed the construction referendum by 55%. There was probably a difference of about 500 votes. And then the operational referendum was a difference of about 1,000 votes with 60%.
All right. Take a moment, if you will, and go through the two questions. You mentioned the operational question, which is number one. That was on the ballot that people saw if they were in the Hanover Community School Corporation district in the precincts. And the second question was involving the expansion, I guess, for the construction, the bonds, I guess it was. Tell us a little bit more about those two questions.
Well, the first question was in regard to the operational referendum, was just asking the taxpayer if they were willing to continue the operational referendum that was passed in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we learned last year when we went out was some of the taxpayers and residents said, don't ask for money and then come back next year and ask again. So our operational referendum hadn't really expired, but we decided to combine them so that we didn't have to come back to renew. So that was not an increase. We just asked taxpayers if they were willing to continue to support that going forward for 7 years. And that was tax neutral at 29 cents per 100.
Mm-hmm. That was the really important, other than the expansion that you wanted to be able to take care of, I understand, for future generations of Hanover Community School students and the patrons. It was a way to be able to make sure that the school district got the support that it needed. And I imagine it came at a very, very important time, because we know that the property tax caps will have an impact on the school district, won't they?
Absolutely. To the tune of about a loss of $450,000.
Wow, wow. Is there anything in particular that you have planned? And obviously you have to consult with the school board about this and get some public support for some things, I would imagine. But has the school board thought about, and have you talked with them in particular about anything in will come about in the upcoming school year?
Well, right now, Chris, the focus is, you know, it's funny, the celebration for this is just, it's incredible, because we needed this so desperately. Our kids are in trailers in two of the buildings. We're out of space. But as soon as that celebration ended, now we're really focused on safe reopening of school with reentry considerations. And there's a lot to consider there, because we don't have the luxury of space. So that's going to require quite a bit of thinking and time.
When it came to putting things together as far as the operational request that was question number one, was there anything in particular that you had felt that you needed to go over again? Although you mentioned the fact it was really a continuation of the question which had passed before, did you feel maybe a little uncomfortable or maybe not so sure that the voters might support the continuation the second time around?
No, I was pleasantly surprised. They know that we used that money for, you know, to attract and retain exceptional staff, help eliminate the deficit. We also did a yearly flyer to let the taxpayers know how we were using that money. We wanted them to know we have done exactly what we said we were going to do, and we're being very transparent.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not overly surprised that it passed by such a huge margin.
Now, you mentioned briefly here, just at the outset of our conversation, about the question number two, which deals with the construction bond issue. Will you tell us in a little bit more detail what you have planned, that you had asked for in that second question, and the voters in Hanover Township approved?
Sure. We are going to take our two current elementary buildings that are K-5, and in order to provide more space, we're going to make that a K-2 building. Those are going to be two K-2 buildings. Mm-hmm. We will build a new grades 3 through 5 building on the middle school property so that 3 through 5 will have its own separate building. We're going to do massive renovations at the high school so that we can reconfigure trades classes and science classes and STEM opportunities. It just needs to be updated. The high school improvements are comparable to the cost of the new building.
Oh.
And then we're doing improvements to the middle school. We're going to build a corporation resource center to house all of our buses. Right now, they're in a parking lot. So we're going to house them and be able to maintain them with our own mechanic. So that's going to be a huge savings.
Okay. When you went forth during the opportunity that you had to get with voters here, unfortunately, it was, of course, I'm sure, changed dramatically as far as your outreach is concerned because of the coronavirus pandemic. What did you all have to do in the time that you had before the election to be able to get the word out, to be sure that everybody had all their questions answered?
Well, I'll tell you, we had people just come out of the woodwork supporting the referendum and, you know, just driving by and knowing that something has to happen. We changed our entire campaign to mailers, postcards, social media. So we had people that, you know, helped support that effort because we couldn't go door to door. We did phone calling. Everything was done, I guess, remotely, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. either by phone or by mail. And social media was a huge part of that.
Now, on election day, obviously you would have, if things had been as normal, so to speak, that you would have known later that evening on how the referendum questions ended up. But you had to wait so long. Did you and your staff there in the administration building have to kind of change gears a bit to be prepared for a lengthy wait? And we're talking about maybe up to 72 hours before finding out for sure?
Yeah, and all I can say to that is it was so painstaking to wait. We thought we were confident based on the numbers we had seen that it looked like it had passed, but there were still 39 precincts that were incomplete, and I just didn't feel good about publishing a letter to families and community to say it passed unless I knew that 100%. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was very stressful, and we also didn't get an opportunity to collectively get together and watch like we did with the previous referendum that had failed.
Right.
You know, we were all assembled in one place, so we didn't have the luxury of that. We had a Zoom meeting. So
that's about as close as you can get to having a regular meeting, I suppose, yeah.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But our sense of elation is just unparalleled. We're so happy. And we know this is going to be good things for our kids and our community for years to come.
Now, the election was held on Tuesday, June 2nd. When was it that you finally got the word from the Board of Elections and Voter Registration Office with the unofficial count? It's not official, but it's pretty official, isn't it?
Yeah, Thursday, June 4th.
Mm-hmm. That's right. All right, now that you have the word, you have the go-ahead from the voters in South Lake County in the Hanover Community School Corporation District. You mentioned a little bit here about the procedure you have to go through. What is the next step that you and the school board members will do as you start to get, in particular with the construction bond issue, to get the actual construction projects going?
Well, interestingly enough, that I have a meeting next week to mm-hmm. meet with the architectural firm and the construction manager to talk about next steps. And then they're going to meet with the board. You know, I do want community input into the building projects. I think that's important. So I guess I'm going to get a timeline of what needs to happen and when and how we go about doing that. But and I want I want to be very transparent with that and involve the community and let them know what's going on every step of the way.
Did you get any particular remarks from some of the people who live in the school district, either right before the election or ever since the elections come out and you've officially known here, as to how they felt about the questions that are up and their just general feelings about what the school district wants to do to be able to improve education in Hanover Township?
Well, before we even, we had submitted three different proposals for the community's consideration. And part of that, we also did surveys asking people to comment on what they thought was important and what they valued. So the building plan, that the three plans were a result of input we got from the community. And that was so valuable. And by the time the three plans went out, we asked homeowners, which of these would you be willing to support? And overwhelmingly, it was the $79 million project.
Well, once again, congratulations. It's wonderful news to be able to pass on to residents in South Lake County that the school district has gotten the support from the patrons, the voters, to be able to do the things that need to be done to keep the Hanover Community School Corporation going strong and making the improvements that they need to make for the years ahead. Thank you for spending some time to go over things with us to talk about it today.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hanover Community School Corporation Superintendent Mary Tracy McCauley. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Building Northwest Indiana. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. My guest today is Alex Lulinski. Alex is a senior project manager with Berglund Construction. Berglund Construction is a fourth-generation, family-owned and operated construction and building restoration firm. The company is headquartered in Chicago, but also has several satellite offices, including one in Chesterton, Indiana. Some of Berglund's notable projects in Northwest Indiana include Centier Bank headquarters in Merrillville, the Mascot Hall of Fame in Whiting, the William E. Urschel Pavilion in Valparaiso, the Stardust Event Center expansion at the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, and they are just about wrapped up on a new bioscience building at the Purdue Northwest campus in Hammond. Today, Alex and I will be talking about the responsibilities of a construction project manager. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the schedule a little bit. How is that developed? Do you work with the owner and develop the schedule or work with your subs? Do you have to give them a guaranteed date on when you are supposed to be completed with the project? How does that all work in this project delivery system?
In the project delivery system, it's all – the schedule ties into several factors. I mean, you have your budget. You have to budget your general conditions, general requirements into a timeline to make sure you're not running over on your own staffing. The owner gave us a target date on when they want this project to be completed, so we just backed into that, and that's how we derived to our overall schedule duration.
So how did you get involved in project management? What was your career path? Did you have you always been working for Berglund, or how did you get into the business?
I have a very interesting career path. I went to school at Ball State University for telecommunications, emphasis in TV production. I wanted my own hunting and fishing show. Things didn't work out the way I thought they would, and I always did residential construction all through high school, all through college, a couple years after college. And I got on a project, some HUD housing in Gary. And it was my first project where there was a job site. It was an actual big job site. It wasn't just a one-unit residential home. The whole site was fenced in. There was a job trailer there. There was a superintendent sitting in the trailer. The PM would come for meetings. And that was the first experience I've had with bigger construction, commercial, industrial, everything of that aspect outside of residential. And my company sent me to the foreman's meetings, So I would go, I would attend those foreman's meetings, and that's when it kind of clicked in my head, hey, I want to be that guy sitting in the trailer. So I went back to school to, it was called Purdue Kell at the time, not Purdue Northwest, and they offered a construction management certificate program, which I took that. And then I, my first job once I got my certificate was with a small union glazing shop. I applied at Berglund Construction before I took that job, and about a month after I was there, I got a call from Berglund and decided to jump ship and been here ever since.
So what year was that?
2007 I started with Berglund.
So you've been with Berglund here going on 13, 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you had to do it all over again, what would you tell your younger self at the start of your career to help advance your career maybe a little bit quicker?
What I would have told my younger self is find something more realistic that you wanted to do with your future and stick with it. I've always liked construction. I love seeing it. It's a very rewarding job. You get to see things come together, and you can, if you're driving with your family, you can drive by the building and say, I was heavily involved in that project, making that project, delivering that project for the owner, seeing the smiles on the owner's face when you're complete. So I guess I would just tell myself, I should have got into construction or the commercial side of things much sooner and with my education.
So tell us about the Purdue Bioscience Building project. I know you've been the senior project manager on that project. That project is coming to completion, if I'm not wrong. When is that project expected to be completed?
Right now we're starting to punch out the building.
And when you say punch out, what does that mean?
Berglund, it's a joint venture with Powers and Sons. So Berglund Powers, we go through and we do initial punch, which is anything from blemishes in the paint to something that's just installed incorrectly, and then assign it to the sub so they can correct it. And then we go through and we punch it, and then the architect follows us, and he does his punch list. And then we assign him to the subs to get everything turned around before substantial completion.
And you're currently working on that process right now?
Yep.
Going to have a ribbon cutting?
There will be a ribbon cutting. I don't have an official date from the university yet, but I believe it will be in August. Well, Kevin, I'm involved from everything from financials to schedule coordination. Primarily, once we get through the financials of the upfront bidding process and budgeting, we roll that. You have to watch the costs throughout the project, but heavily involved in coordinating. Making sure the subs are there, making sure they are ordering their product, getting their submittals in, making sure it is the right product when it does come to the site. Because believe it or not, a lot of times some people will try and cheat. Schedule, constantly watching schedule. And that, again, once involves all the material lead times, manpower issues. When you approach the summers, subs typically get spread pretty thin with all the school projects, so you're trying to lock in the guys before, start talking all your subs, making sure they're going to have the manpower that they need over that summer rush.
Have you been noticing a workforce shortage?
At this time, no. But every summer, yeah, it's an issue.
Does it delay your projects or add more cost to it?
Sometimes it can. I know we ran into a couple issues with a couple different subs on this specific project where they were spread thin, so they started working 10s and Saturdays just because the halls are empty.
Let's get to that. How do you hire your workforce? I think a lot of our listeners, Berglund doesn't employ all these workers, or the subcontractors doesn't employ them at all times. They're actually hired through a local hiring hall. Can you explain that process?
Berglund's problem, when we self-perform, Berglund has a process where you apply online. You have to go to a fit for duty test, which is, a couple of stringent, it's cardio and lifting and things like that to make sure you are fit for duty. We hire only 100% union workforce, so we have the union requirements too if they have drug testing and whatever policies they might have. But a lot of our self-perform work, we've had those people on board for so long now that they just keep coming back year after year. But when we do have to hire additional, we do go directly to union halls and ask for their guys, and whoever's first on the list is who we get.
And the advantage of doing that is it gives you a pool of skilled workers that allow you to expand and contract so you could build large projects or small projects as needed.
Yeah, I mean, that way, I mean, going through the unions, you know you're getting a skilled worker who's been trained to do his job, and he's getting a fair pay, pension, and health care. So it's a good workforce, and we like working with them.
If our listeners are interested in finding a little bit more about your company, Berkeland Construction, is there anywhere that they can go on the World Wide Web to find that information?
Yes, they can. They can go to www.berglandco.com.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you, Kevin.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I would like to thank our guest, Alex Lulinski, Senior Project Manager with Berglund Construction. To find out more information about Berglund Construction, please visit berglundco.com.
And support for Building Northwest Indiana is brought to you by the Construction Advancement Foundation. Podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with an intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
We grew up in the neighborhood that was near Pulaski School. My grandfather lived in the neighborhood. He didn't live on our block, but he lived a couple blocks over. And he had come to Gary, gotten a job at the steel mill, was very active in the union, in the United Steelworkers Union, was a griever for the coke plant, because at that time, most African Americans who worked for U.S. Steel worked in the coke plant, because it was the dirtiest place in the mill. But I guess they made what was a decent salary at that time. So he encouraged my father to leave Florida and move to Gary. All of my folks, my father and my mother's side, they were all from Florida, Gainesville, Alachua, Florida. And so that's how we ended up coming to Gary. My mother did day work, and I don't know if you know what day work is, but that is when they went to white people's houses and cleaned them up. My mother used to catch the bus and do that. We called it East Gary at the time before they changed their name. They didn't want to be associated with Gary, and they changed it to Lake Station. But she worked in East Gary. She also worked doing day work at some houses here in Gary. On Fifth Avenue, there were a lot of doctors who worked at the hospital who lived on Fifth Avenue in those tall apartment buildings that you see now. They lived there. My mother worked in some of those. And so that's what she did. And my dad worked at U.S. Steel. I know whatever he did, wherever it was hot. I remember him saying that. He would come home and say it was so hot, you know. And at one point, they were laid off for some reason, and he worked at a cleaner's. And then after he went back to U.S., he did that part-time. He worked at a cleaner's. He was, as he would say, a presser. He would press clothes. I know my grandfather worked at the coke plant, and he did a lot to help as many African-Americans as he could. Well, he helped them get employment and helped them to not be mistreated. And he was very involved. And he would take me at one point down on Fifth Avenue. They called it the Philip Murray Building. The lady who worked in the office was black. She was African-American, Jeanette Strong. And he and some other white guys who were in the union were instrumental in getting her a clerical position there. I was probably too young to remember, you know, when he became involved in the union. I just know that he was, and I know that even after he left the area, some guys who worked at the coke plant had said to me, I remember your grandfather. He was really active. He did a lot of things to help us. As a matter of fact, Curtis Strong was the person who took his position after he left, retired, and moved back to Florida. And he said a lot of the accomplishments those guys in the coke plant achieved was because of my grandfather. So I felt real good about that. Yes, I did. I still do.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And, of course, from time to time, we have an opportunity to talk to a noted veteran Indiana economist, speaker, and column writer, Morton Marcus, about topics of interest involving the Hoosier State's economy. And how do things shape up these days in the age of coronavirus? Well, let's find out. Morton, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Always a pleasure.
Well, you have a number of your Eye on the Pie columns that focus in on something related to the COVID-19 virus, and some that kind of turned into all kinds of things. But let's take a look at the COVID-19 epidemic as it's turned into. Talk about, if you will, I guess one column in particular that is entitled, Why Must We Stay Apart? What are your concerns there?
Well, this is a question that I think many of us have asked, and it has to do with just the science of the way this virus spreads. You know, we've never faced anything like this. Our economy has never had a hit such as this. We got through World War II with, minimal discomforts. We had people working 24 hours a day. Now we have people at home 24 hours a day. And it's such a different environment. Most of us, almost every single person alive today, was not involved with the pandemic of 1918, 1919. So we just don't have experience here. And I think that many of our responses have been appropriate, but very different in different places. And this is always going to be the case in America because we're a very, very diverse people. And we just don't recognize that. I think this is one of the things that we should recognize, that we are not the kinds of families that are represented on television. So much that we see on television about American family life is not what we experience. My concern here is that what we recognize as this COVID-19 problem is that with something we haven't experienced before. And instead of, in a way, taking some pleasure in it, most people are just complaining about it. I haven't been very distressed by it, but that's because I'm retired. I'm not like people who are currently working, and they have every right to be concerned. Mm-hmm. There are people who are at home with their children. Well, I'm only at home with the dogs and cats, and my wife is out doing good things because other people are in a sick condition, so she's out there helping those who are having troubles. So we have lots of different experiences, and we have to understand that about ourselves. I've had a chance to do things that I've never done in my life. I sat here one day looking out at the few trees we have here, and I could actually, over the hours of the day, see the leaves that were coming forth. Now, I've never done that in my life. You know, people talk about sitting around watching the grass grow or watching the corn grow. Well, one day I had an opportunity to watch the leaves come out on the trees. And I think we have to understand that there are opportunities, there are things we can do that are very positive for ourselves and for our families. I know a lot of folks that I know, a lot of the fellows are finally working on those projects that they had in their garage for years and were going to get to, and some of them are getting to them. And that's a positive approach to what is a very uncomfortable situation, mm-hmm. but not one that we can't live through and in a way even celebrate.
I know you mentioned in the column about the need to, I guess, to take a better look at the research that's going to come about from all of this, and you think that that's going to have a benefit for the Hoosier economy in general, I imagine.
Oh, I think very definitely. Many companies are going to look at how they operate and figure out that there are things that they're doing that just aren't productive, that don't increase their revenues in any way, and are just ways of spending money. And this is, in some cases, going to cost jobs. Mm-hmm. But then there are employees who are going to say, I haven't had a job that I liked for a long time. If I'm going to make myself happy, I'm going to go out and I'm going to find a job that I prefer. And when people start hiring again, I'm an experienced worker, I'm going to find a job. And they may spend some of that time doing things like getting their resume in shape, and they may start thinking about how they present themselves. They may go through and throw out some of their old ties, which indicate that they haven't done an interview in 15 years. And maybe some of the employers won't expect a tie any longer. You know, there's changes that are going to take place here. They're small changes. It's not going to be excessively dramatic. But I think that people have an opportunity to improve themselves in this situation.
I know a couple of your On the Pie columns recently, one of them, I guess, the end of April, and the other one here, I guess, less than a month later, just a few weeks ago. Take a look at the region. Now, we're not necessarily talking about the Calumet region, as people up here, of course, call it, but we're just right. talking regional governments and regions in Indiana in general. And one of them you talk about in particular about the issue about regions and about maybe now they're with this opportunity to do some redistribution because of the coronavirus pandemic and how it's changed our economy. That might come about. If you will, bring us up today about your thoughts about the regional government or regional opportunities, I should say, that are out there.
For Northwest Indiana, this has been something that's there every single day for the past 50 years at least. There are now, I believe it's 19 cities and towns in Lake County alone.
Mm-hmm.
19 of them. Why? This doesn't make any sense any longer. You know, we no longer travel by horse and wagon. We're in a situation where we're not really dependent on public transportation, and people can get around very easily. How much of a difference is there between Highland and Munster and Griffith? I'm sure each one has a history, and they remember certain things, and they each have high schools which they love and admire. That's fine, but there are many things that they could do together that would allow them to have their separate identities and still join together as a municipality. And we've got St. John, and we've got Dyer, and we've got Schererville. And again, it's the same kind of thing. Why aren't they more together? We've got how many chambers of commerce? Almost every one of them unnecessary. We've seen a few of them beginning to get together to recognize there's just no point to some of these differences. And you can then spread out and go over the county lines, which were just drawn on a map at some time that have no particular meaning, and ask yourself, aren't there things that we could do that would bring LaPorte and Porter and Lake County closer together? Is there really a need for Jasper and Newton to be separate counties? It doesn't make any sense at all. These forms of government that we have inherited from the 19th century, here we are 2 centuries later, 200 years later, and we're still using exactly the same format. And people say, well, you know, my town is my town, and it's a different place, and you're going to destroy my memories. Well, you can be in charge of your memories, and let's get on with the future. One of the things that has disturbed me, and it's not in any of my columns, but one of the things that has disturbed me in this epidemic is we spend every night on television and on the radio or in our newspapers celebrating the lives of people who have died. And yet, we have 220 children born in the state of Indiana every day. Every day, we have about 220. That's what we average. Why aren't we celebrating their births, and why aren't we thinking about their futures instead of spending so much time with the grief of death. The grief of death is legitimate, and it's wonderful to honor them, but we should spend more of our energy and more of our thinking on those who are just coming into our world. Mm-hmm.
And I know, too, that we talk here about new people born into the state of Indiana, which means that the young people will have to be educated. And one of the columns you have out fits in nicely with the fact that we just had a primary election at which some of the counties in Indiana have added on questions on school district referenda. In fact, one school district in Porter County, one school district here in Lake County just brought it up on the polls here, and the concern about the referenda. And you have some very definite views about that and about the importance of education, public education in particular.
Well, I don't think there's any question about the importance of public education. Mm-hmm. I think what we have to ask ourselves is, what do we mean by education? And what I see some of these bond issues headed for is improving sports facilities. Well, I'm not against sports in high school. I don't think we should discontinue having sports in high school. But I don't know that we need to do them at the level that we do them in terms of the intensity and the amount of money that we spend on. If the people in Highland who support the Highland High School want their children involved in these things, there's a Highland Rotary Club, I suspect, and there may be a Highland Kiwanis Club, and let them adopt the sports programs to move them forward. I visited my school district here, and what I learned is that they needed to redo the locker rooms. And they needed to redo the locker rooms so they can attract athletes. Now, this sounds like college sports, not high school sports. Mm-hmm. But what's happened in the state of Indiana is that you can send your child to just about any high school you want to, and the state will see to it that the money is transferred from the high school where you reside to the high school where your child is going. And if you're doing that just because you're considering the future career or the pleasure of your child being on a team, that's not education. That's not education at all. That's sort of personal greed, and why are we committing public resources to this? I'm very concerned about that kind of activity where we have schools trying to attract athletes so that they can have winning records, so they can have a trophy when you walk into the school. That's not what education is about. I think those schools that put their best students, put their pictures into the entryway of the school instead of, boosting their athletes. I was driving down, I guess it was Kennedy Avenue one day, and I saw these banners that are up on the light poles, and they all talked about their high school athletes. Mm-hmm. And Highland isn't alone in doing this. I'm not picking on them, but that's what the parents want. And why are we even doing that when we ought to be celebrating the restaurants that we have in town and celebrating the small businesses that we have in town instead of the, glorifying and magnifying the activities of our children, making them think that they're more important than they are because they're on a high school football team or basketball team or whatever it may be. That's a lack of understanding of the purpose of education. Parents are the problems that we have. Parents who don't really care about education and, in fact, are very happy to take their children out of school for an extended period of time if it means going with the traveling team somewhere on a weekend and getting away from doing homework and getting away from becoming a citizen of the United States.
Well, Morton, we always appreciate hearing your views on the stories. And whether
you
it's
mean my ranting. That's
no,
what you
No.
You enjoy my ranting.
Well, okay, we enjoy your ranting, too, especially when it deals, especially when it has to do with Indiana's economy and communities in Indiana, in particular here in Northwest Indiana. And as always, we thank you for spending time with us today, and we'll have you back on again real soon with more Eye on the Pie columns to talk about.
Fine. I look forward to it. Thanks so much.
Mort Marcus is a noted Indiana economist, a writer, a public speaker, and you get to hear him here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Being a young person can sometimes be very difficult, especially if you come from a home that's troubled because of abuse or other issues. The Lake County CASA program was created in 1987 to represent children with the help of specially trained volunteers appointed by judges to make sure that the youngsters don't get lost in the legal and social service system or languish in inappropriate group or foster homes. Liz Theodorus is the volunteer recruitment coordinator of the CASA program. She came on Regionally Speaking to talk about the program, how it's helped youth for more than 30 years, and how volunteers are trained to be able to assist the children in need. Here's the conversation.
The CASA program was started in 1987 here in Lake County. There are CASA programs throughout the state and the country. We are child advocates, and in the state of Indiana, we are appointed by law or by statute to represent the best interest of abused and neglected children.
When you look at this idea of having somebody who is a certainly an advocate, somebody who speaks up for the children, it's very important that they have somebody, some grown-up especially, to be able to do this. It has to be terribly intimidating for a young person to come in for whatever reason into the court system, and it's like you feel like a tiny little person with these huge grown-ups around you, and a lot of gobbledygook is being spoken, and especially if you end up in a court proceeding of some type, and they probably have no idea why they're there.
Right. And so our volunteers, they represent children in these matters of child abuse and neglect. And so we represent newborn children all the way up to 18. And so these children, through no fault of their own, find themselves as wards of the state. And this process is one of providing services to these children and their families who face many problems. Poverty, domestic violence, there's physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, there's educational neglect, medical neglect, all the things that you read about or hear about in the media. These are the issues that these families are and children are dealing with. And so a volunteer takes a case, and they are charged with visiting the child on a regular basis about once a month, and then they attend hearings about every 3 months. And nothing is done for these children unless it's court-ordered. Mm-hmm. And so the Department of Child Services, they're the folks that provide the services for the children and the families to help them heal and to remedy the situation as to why the case came in to begin with. And so it's a process of gathering information. How is the child doing in their placement? They may be in foster care. So the volunteer would visit the child in their foster home, gather information about how the child is doing in that placement, how are they doing with services. And then we attend, as a staff member, we attend a hearing with the volunteer and provide fact-based information to the court and to a judge who is going to make orders for the child.
Do the volunteers, because they're in contact with the child and with the family members on these particular cases, are they kind of a conduit of information to the DCS? Although the DCS has caseworkers, of course, they're going to be taking care of the matter too, but do they offer more information maybe than what the DCS can handle? Because a caseworker has so many individual cases that one particular person has to handle. They can't possibly know everything, and they certainly can't find out everything right away.
Absolutely, and we As CASA, we definitely collaborate with the Department of Child Services. And so we exchange information, and we get that information into the courtroom. And so our volunteers gather information. They share information with the Department of Child Services. There's a family case manager for every child abuse case, child neglect case that comes in. And so... the Department of Child Services, they're a legal party to these cases. CASA, we're a legal party to the case, and the parent is a legal party to the case.
How does Senior Judge Thomas Stefaniak, who is the judge in Lake Superior Court Juvenile Division that is overseeing all of this, how does he fit into this as far as CASA is concerned? And how does he feel about having all these volunteers helping out to do some work that certainly he couldn't or even his own court staff couldn't handle?
Sure. Well, Judge Stefaniak, he presides over the very first hearings in this abuse and neglect process. And so he hears the very first cases. They're called detention hearings. And they're scheduled every Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 1 o'clock. I do attend those hearings as a CASA representative in the courtroom because it's at these very first hearings is when CASA, he appoints CASA to the case and to these matters. So we have many, many cases that come in every single week.
We're talking with Liz Theodoros, who is the volunteer recruitment coordinator for the Lake County CASA program. How long have the volunteer training programs been going underway? Probably ever since or before the CASA program got started, I would imagine.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, in 1987, the CASA program was started in Lake County, and we serve abused and neglected children all throughout our county. And so our training gives a very good overview of child welfare in Lake County. We do two trainings a year. There is an application process and an interview process. And so the training consists of 30 hours. We break that into 10 evenings, 6:15 to 8:30, Tuesday, Thursday evenings. Volunteers given a manual. That's theirs for their reference. There's 10 chapters that covers child welfare issues and some of the legal process. We give them some courtroom observation. And so we really prepare them to be able to finish the training and take a case. They're sworn in at the very end of the training as an officer of the juvenile court. They take an oath of confidentiality and then they begin their casework. They come in to our office. They work with a staff member, a case coordinator, and select a case, whatever case feels right for them.
What kind of person seems to work best as a volunteer in the CASA program? That may be a very simple question. And for a very, very complex answer, there are lots of different people that want to be involved, but who would likes to be involved and become a court-appointed advocate?
Well, no, that's really a great question because this is a very specialized field. And so in my experience, I've been on staff for 17 years, and I've been recruiting and screening and training volunteers for that period of time. And person that works best in these cases as a volunteer is someone that has a heart for children. And however, we really appreciate someone who is a good communicator and also someone that does not have a problem with the emotionality of this work. And so while it is emotional work, we really emphasize that, you can't be very emotional because it compromises your ability to advocate objectively.
It sounds like you have to have somebody who has, a good head on their shoulders.
Absolutely.
Because you have to be impartial, but you have to be and compassionate, but you also have to be sure that you're aware of what's going on and keep everything in context that they happen to hear and see, I would imagine.
Definitely. Absolutely. And so, someone who's very resourceful and can find some answers for these children when there are no apparent answers sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you're going through the process of getting ready to select the next series of volunteers, but you're obviously looking for volunteers, as you say, a couple times a year is when the volunteer training program is underway. If
yes.
anybody is interested, how can they find out more and who should they contact?
Okay, they can contact myself, my phone number at my office, at my desk, 219-660-6978. And I have an email that's quite easy. It's Lake County CASA lakecountycasa@gmail.com. All one word.
Agree. Liz Theodoros is the volunteer recruitment coordinator for the Lake County CASA program, which is administered out of the Lake County Superior Court Juvenile Division. And Judge Thomas Stefaniak is the senior judge of the courts. And he is the fellow who is in charge of these cases that come up before him as a juvenile matter. And he, in turn, has been able to endorse and continue working on a program all these years. And that probably has made a lot of people very happy. And hopefully you've seen some successful cases come out of all of this, I would imagine.
Absolutely. The happiest, most joyful cases are the adoption cases. Mm-hmm. And so once a year, Judge Stefaniak puts together an adoption day. And so all the magistrates and Department of Child Services and CASA and the court staff at Juvenile, we all come together and, oh gosh, we've done, you know, anywhere from 40 to 50 adoptions on that particular day. And we have a service, a comfort dog at Juvenile, Moxie, and she partakes also.
And that's it for a special edition of Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in to Regionally Speaking tomorrow.